you know, every governor leaves his or her imprint through the policies that get enacted by their cabinet. I want to assure that I have that opportunity as well.
Governor Sean Parnell keeps his job. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 3rd of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the impact of the Native vote.
The Native community stepped up big time. We put a lot of money where our mouth is, and I don't think any politician in Alaska will ever ignore the Native community again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doy Unlimited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Alaskans voted yesterday to keep their governor and U.S. congressman and may have made history with their U.S. Senate vote. A write-in candidate hasn't won a Senate seat in 56 years. But Lisa Murkowski is on a trajectory to make history.
We're liking our trend. We like the position that we're in right now, but we still have many votes outstanding. We know that there's going to be a lot of absentees that we will have to wait for. But I think Alaskans have spoken.
With 98.6% of precincts reporting, the write-in has 41% of the vote. Republican candidate Joe Miller is trailing by 13,500 ballots. Democrat Scott McAdams is in third with about a quarter of the vote. Just what exactly more than 81,000 Alaskans wrote on the line remains to be seen, however. The State Division of Elections has to read each ballot individually. Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell announced today that examining the write-ins will start a week sooner than initially planned on November 10th. He expects it to take 3 days. Officials say voter intent is key and simple misspellings will be accepted. 160 other people signed up as write-ins last week in an attempt to create chaos and confuse voters. They were prompted to do so by conservative Joe Miller supporters. But despite that, it was a good day for the incumbents Alaska sends to Washington. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Lisa Murkowski spent the last 6 weeks telling voters to write in her name and fill in the oval next to it. Whether enough Alaskans actually did that successfully won't be known for weeks, but the incumbent senator was optimistic on election night.
This is a little surreal. We're on the verge of history here.
Murkowski says if she wins, she'll still caucus with Republicans in Washington, but will have a clear loyalty.
This is not consulting the Republican Party platform to see where they are on an issue. This is consulting Alaskans. It means a lot more kind of day-to-day contact with all Alaskans, everyday Alaskans, not just the Chamber of Commerce types, but folks all over the spectrum.
Democrat Scott McAdams, who looks to be in third place, says he hopes Murkowski keeps in mind his message and the support he got from across the state.
You know, I hope that Alaskans do hold Senator Murkowski to the spirit of her campaign because she has been one of the most conservative members of the United States Senate over the last couple of years. And I hope that this will moderate her voice should she win.
The former Sitka mayor says he feels part of a strong grassroots movement that shows Alaska isn't just a red Republican state. McAdams raised over $1 million and is proud that none of it came from political action committees.
Small towns matter. Community matters. The people who stand up and account for themselves on matters of policy and budget, these people do have experience. They do matter. They do count.
The Republican nominee, Joe Miller, did not show up last night at the Egan Center, Anchorage's election central. Campaign manager Robert Campbell says his candidate is not conceding and will watch for the rest of the returns and the write-in counts.
I don't think this energy goes away, and I'll tell you why. Because it was always there, it was just untapped. The energy in this crowd and the supporters for Joe Miller, I mean, it's not just about Joe the man, it's about the message and it's about the vision. And that vision inspires so much energy and just so much passion.
But Miller's message of slashing government spending and complaints about an entitlement mentality didn't appear to gain enough traction in a state used to its delegation bringing home the bacon. One of the biggest proponents of earmarks and sending money home to Alaska, Congressman Don Young, cruised to victory in his race Tuesday with more than two-thirds the votes in his favor. Young says he talked yesterday with Ohio Congressman John Boehner, who's likely to be the new Republican Speaker of the House.
We have always been very frank with one another, and we're actually, I won't say good friends, but we respect one another, and that's crucially important in this business. He knows I'm not going to put up with any of his crap if he's wrong, and I'm not going to be, he's going to put up with my crap if I'm wrong. And that's simply what we do, and that's good. None of this stuff is going to be right up front. We know where we're coming from. I know where he's coming from, and we can work together that way.
Young beat back a challenge by Democratic state legislator Harry Crawford, who says he's not giving up on politics.
I love being a part of the decision-making process. I love being able to push things like Fire Island and Lake Chacachama and renewable energy forward. So, yeah, I'm going to be around.
Crawford and other politicians may be scoping out what's next, but as the dust settles from Election Day, it will be a while before the exact makeup of Alaska's congressional delegation is known. In Anchorage, I'm Libby Casey.
Late this afternoon, Lisa Murkowski announced a legal defense fund established to deal with expected litigation over write-in ballots. Governor Sean Parnell today took the first steps in creating his own administration that will be different from what he inherited when Sarah Palin quit last year. It is the same step taken when one governor takes over from another, and since it didn't take place when Palin left office, it could indicate a noticeable break from the past. He is asking for resignations from all Palin appointees at the cabinet level, division directors, and agency heads. Parnell says they can reapply for the jobs, and he will consider the applications, but indicated that some will likely be rejected.
I wouldn't ask for resignations if I didn't anticipate change. You know, every governor leaves his or her imprint through the policies that get enacted by their cabinet. I want to assure that I have that opportunity as well, and that's what I'm working to do.
Parnell says he is asking for recommendations on the structure of the administration as well. New governors usually review the work of various departments under their control, but Parnell is looking for an interdepartmental review centered on the topics that each department deals with. These vary, with one working group dealing with energy and environment, another on health and education, still another on public safety. There are six overlapping topics in all, each with its own group of external reviewers. He says government can always improve.
That's my charge as governor to these groups, is tell us how we can improve. It's soliciting public input on how we can improve performance. So rather than, you know, call out a particular agency, I think every group, whether it's this office as governor's office or whether it's an agency, I think we can improve when it comes to serving the public.
The transition will be headed by Brian Butcher, currently the director of government relations for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Parnell says he expects to receive the reports in December. Governor Parnell will still have to get his own new agenda through the legislature next year. As Dave Donaldson reports, he will find a little less opposition to what he wants in the House, but in the Senate, very little seems to have changed.
Republicans added two seats to their House majority following yesterday's results, going from 22 to 24 members. However, the Senate remains a 10-10 split along party lines, which will call for the creation of another bipartisan coalition before they go into session. Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski, who co-chairs the coalition's Resources Committee, said last night that the system has worked well for the past 4 years.
People have rejected the partisanship on the D.C. level, and I think people like the bipartisanship on the Senate level in Alaska. I think we've got a lot accomplished with that, and hopefully we can continue that with a 10-10 Senate. You have to do that.
And Senate Rules Chair Wasilla Republican Charlie Huggins says he thinks Americans would be happier if the Alaska Senate organization were superimposed on Congress.
I'm a Republican, and I would prefer a supermajority of Republicans, but we don't have that. But the one thing I do know is important is that we do right by Alaskans. I'm happy for the governor and look forward to working with him. But, I mean, we have to figure out a path forward.
Huggins says the bipartisan organization has been successful because members agreed to postpone the more polarizing issues so they could take care of the essential business of the state. The House, meanwhile, saw three incumbents fall yesterday. With all but the absentee and questioned ballots counted, Fairbanks Republican Mike Kelly lost to Democrat Bob Miller. Anchorage Democrat Bob Book lost to his Republican challenger, Mia Costello. and with all the votes still not counted in the district, Woody Salmon appears to have lost his Interior Alaska seat to Republican Alan Dick. Also, voters for the seat vacated by Democrat Harry Crawford chose Republican Lance Pruitt to take his place. Anchorage Democrat Chris Tuck said the increase in the Republican majority means Democrats will have to work harder.
When you have balanced numbers in the legislature, you end up with balanced policies and you end up with good legislation for the state of Alaska. I am concerned that special interests might end up taking over and might be hard to come up with policies that everyone can be proud of.
During the past 2 years, three Democrats have joined with the majority Republicans. And that's a possibility again as members begin to organize later this week in advance of next year's session. I'm Dave Donaldson in Anchorage.
Just moments ago, the Senate Majority Coalition announced that it has reorganized for next year's session. Kodiak Republican Gary Stevens will again serve as Senate President. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a witness recounts a brutal killing in Bethel.
I thought they might turn on me. And I hear I'm one guy, unarmed, and I just, you know, I know these guys are killers now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Native Corporation's efforts to get out the vote for Senator Lisa Murkowski in rural parts of Alaska appear to have worked. In the weeks before Election Day, the group's Alaskans Standing Together, a political action committee made up of 12 regional Native corporations, spent more than $1.2 million supporting Murkowski's write-in bid. It also had volunteers go door-to-door in rural villages to drum up support for her campaign. In District 38, which includes Bethel and surrounding villages, write-ins got 76% of the vote, compared to 14% for Democrat Scott McAdams and 9% for Republican nominee Joe Miller. In the Bristol Bay and Aleutian Islands area, District 37, write-ins got 61% of the vote. Angoon Senator State Senator Albert Kukesh's home community voted 81% for write-ins. Kukesh is a Democrat, but also a Sealaska Corporation board member. He bucked his party to support Murkowski.
Well, I'm a Democrat, and Mr. McAdams is a Democrat. I thought that his time will come, but it's not right now. And Lisa has been a very supportive person, and you can't blame me. I'm an Alaska Native. She was very good to us on Native issues. And why not step up to the plate and say, we want her back?
Murkowski has championed Sealaska's land selection legislation in Congress. The bill would allow the company to choose land outside the original 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act boundaries to complete its entitlement. Another Sealaska board member, Byron Malott, co-chaired Murkowski's statewide campaign. Malott was traveling to Washington, D.C. today and unavailable for comment. The Alaska Federation of Natives, which endorsed Murkowski, canceled a scheduled Senate candidate forum at its recent convention. Kukesh is co-chair of the AFN Board of Directors.
The Native community stepped up big time. We put a lot of money where our mouth is, and I don't think any politician in Alaska will ever ignore the Native community again.
The $1.2 million spent by Alaskans Standing Together was the largest amount spent by a group in Alaska's Senate race. A spokesman for the group could not be reached for comment. In Fairbanks area state house races, Republican incumbent Mike Kelly has been upset by Democrat Bob Miller. Miller benefited from a surge of anti-Kelly mailings and ads in recent weeks. The popular local anchor, actor and former TV newsman says the ads didn't hurt, but he and his campaign were not responsible for them.
The reality was I didn't know who any of these folks were. I wasn't aware of what they were going to do, even that they existed. I mean, I got stuff in my mailbox at the same time anybody else did, and I was pretty surprised to see it.
Miller is a political neophyte who says he expected a tight race, as did Kelly. Kelly says the attack ads contained lies, but that he lives and dies by his hard-line stances on issues.
You know, I went to Juneau to make a difference, to take on the tough issues, to tackle a special interest, to stand up and say something when nobody in the room will.
Kelly narrowly fought back a challenge in the last election, and his defeat this time bucked a trend in local legislative races that saw other incumbents hold on to their seats. Nineteen-year-old Benjamin Kaiser was found dead in Bethel less than a week ago, the victim of what's been called a torturous murder by investigators. Bethel police believe that several people may have known about the incident before they were alerted. Police began investigating when Nick Cook, age 34, of Bethel, came forward. That was 32 hours after he witnessed the crimes. Cook contacted member station KYUK in Bethel to discuss what he saw that day and why he took a day and a half to come forward. Shane Iverson reports, a word of warning here. This story contains graphic and disturbing details.
Nick Cook says he'd been hanging out with the victim, Ben Kaiser, for the last few weeks. They were recently introduced to each other, but Cook said he liked the 19-year-old from Hooper Bay.
We just started becoming friends. He seemed cool. We were talking about hunting walrus.
Cook woke up at about 7:30 on Tuesday, and he noticed some stuff was stolen. He went outside.
And right around here, I see two guys walking, and I recognize them, Jeff and Harry.
That's Harry Ned Williams of Guithluck and Jeff Hout of Bethel, the two that were eventually arrested and charged in the murder. Cook says Williams is his cousin and he's known Hout his whole life. They told him they were looking for a vehicle they said Kaiser had stolen.
And then I offered to drive them look for their truck.
On the road, as they were approaching Hout's house, Hout said he had something to show Cook. Cook says he was totally unprepared for what he was about to see.
And then we end up right by the shop. They call it the shop. And they're like, hey, come check this out. Walk around to these to the shop. And they open the doors and it's dark. So Jeff plugs in the light. And
it's hard for Cook to talk about now, even to think about what he saw that morning. At first, he thought that Kaiser was dead. He was naked and bound to a table, obviously beaten.
They're yelling at him, are you alive? Are you alive? Are you dead? And they're just poking at him with stuff. I mean, I don't even remember. They're just pushing at this body, asking him if he's alive.
Kaiser was unresponsive, but barely breathing. And the beating continued. Cook didn't know what to do.
I thought they might turn on me. And I hear I'm one guy, unarmed, and I just, you know, I know these guys are killers now. That they can do it.
Cook said he did not see running away as an option.
I didn't have no plan. I just started, you know, being cool.
As a matter of survival?
I reckon. I wasn't really thinking.
Cook says they all left the shop and went up to the second story of Hout's residence. Cook says he felt trapped. He listened to Hout talk about mining, afraid to leave. Eventually, discussion turned back to finding the stolen vehicle. Hout went downstairs to fetch a spare key. This left Cook alone with his cousin, Harry Williams, so Cook thought he could talk more freely.
I said, what are you guys gonna do about Ben? And then he looks at me quickly, and it's an intimidation face, so I don't mention it again.
Eventually, he and Williams walked down to the shop where they found Hout. Also there was a neighbor, David Kenny. Cook says he was acquainted with Kenny, and the two started conversing.
And I see his face, he's in shock, like I was when I first saw it, I guess.
Cook says that Hout and Williams talked about throwing Kaiser into the Kuskokwim River, but that the neighbor, Kenny, encouraged them to take Kaiser inside to warmth. Cook says Kenny then left to go to work, leaving him alone once again. Hout and Williams decided to take Kaiser inside. There, Cook's cell phone rang. He says he used that call to try and escape.
I tell Jeff and Harry, oh, hey, my wife called. I forgot I need to send my son to school. They say, yeah, okay, come back after you're done and we'll go look for my truck.
Some would wonder, as soon as you got in your car, you had a cell phone, but you didn't dial the police.
I was just thinking they're not going to get him in time. And even if they do get him, he might get a slap on the wrist. And he'll be out in 10, 15 years to come and get me.
Cook says that Hout owns several rental properties across the street from his house. About a half dozen. Most of them are vacant and facing Cook's house. On Wednesday, Cook saw that the stolen vehicle was now parked on Hout's rental property just across the street. He says this increased his fear that Hout could harm him or his family. Cook says he tried to do normal things like chores, but as he thought about it, he changed his mind.
I just started thinking about how every morning I send my son to school and I tell him he's brave, and I'm proud of him, and what would be the brave thing to do.
Cook says at about 5 p.m. on Wednesday, he contacted a Bethel police officer he trusted. Hout and Williams were arrested about 24 hours later, charged with murder in the first degree.
I wish to send my condolences to Ben's family and everybody in Hooper Bay. I feel really sorry for Jeff's mom and Harry's mom, she's my auntie. But I'm just glad that maybe they'll get justice and the family can have a funeral.
I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com. And by AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A recent conference in Fairbanks examined the problem of invasive species in Alaska. The event was intended to help the public understand the problem and why they should be concerned about it. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
An invasive species is a type of plant or animal that moves in and crowds out native species. It's not just a nuisance, it's a serious and growing problem that affects our lifestyles and economy. Invasive species in Alaska threaten hunting and fishing and industries such as agriculture and forestry. Michelle Hebert, the conference coordinator, says experts at the conference will focus much attention on some of the most troublesome invasive species, those that take root in fresh water.
Probably the ones we are most concerned are the ones that are really well adapted to aquatic situations and can affect spawning grounds of fish, and there's been a lot of examples of that. Even in Anchorage, we started to get purple loosestrife into some of our aquatic zones, and that plant's been known to just fill in whole areas of stream beds where fish spawn.
Hebert is an agriculture and horticulture agent with the UAF Cooperative Extension Service, one of the event sponsors. She says invasive species can make their way into Alaska in unusual ways, like one problem that cropped up along the Iditarod Trail.
They used hay and straw along the Iditarod that was contaminated with some invasive weeds. These plants are beginning to pop up in villages, and people are calling us saying, what are these plants? And, of course, some of them can be damaging to the ecosystem and affect biodiversity out in the community. So we provide information on how to get rid of those when they show up. And we're trying to develop a weed-free certified program so that the only kind of straw and hay that's used for dog bedding along the Iditarod is clean from those type of invasive weed seeds.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Anchorage Assembly Chairman Dick Traney wants to raise the municipality's tobacco tax. A recent public hearing showed the proposed hike is attracting praise from anti-smoking groups, the ire of smokers, and some unanticipated attention from the tobacco industry. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The last assembly increase of Anchorage's tobacco tax was in 2004 and boosted the price of a pack of cigarettes by a dollar. That, too, was a Dick Traney proposal. This time he wants to raise the tax by another 75 cents a pack. The excise tax on other tobacco products would increase from 45% to 55% of the wholesale price. Traney estimates his ordinance would raise between $5.2 to $6.2 million annually. Traney's current proposal would use the new revenues toward reducing property taxes. Yet most of those testifying in favor, like Emily Neenan of the American Cancer Society, were less interested in municipal coffers than young people's lungs.
Tobacco taxes save lives. Whatever you do with the revenue, simply increasing the price of a pack of cigarettes by 10%, which this measure does, decreases youth consumption of cigarettes by 7%.
Jake Williams backed those statistics with an example from his teenage years.
I had a grandfather that was actually going through a serious lung cancer issue and ended up dying. 6 months, very painful, obnoxious death. But that, honestly, was not what changed my mind. Bottom line, when it came down to it, at that time it was about $3 or $4 a pack of cigarettes, I don't remember exact. The way I thought of it was $4 will, that puts 3 or 4 gallons in my tank. That's really what it came down to, was that.
A minority speaking opposed the tax increase. Jim Gillis said, don't expect the 75 cents tax boost to meet predicted revenues.
We already have a very high tax here within the city limits, and I know of a lot of people that go to Soldotna or up to the Valley to get their cigarettes, and I think this might ultimately have a revenue loss for the city, which I think would be devastating at this point.
James Tanner said the tax target was too broad.
Every person has spoken to smoking. I'm a smokeless tobacco user. My use of smokeless tobacco does not impinge upon anybody else's health. I've used it for decades, and I have no health issues related to smokeless tobacco.
During the public hearing, Traney said the proposed tax increase had attracted industry attention.
I have a sister-in-law that lives with me that has COPD now from smoking, and I find it odd because I got an email from her saying how opposed she was to this tax increase. And so I asked Barbara, I said, Barbara, why didn't you just tell me over dinner? Because she lives with me. And she says, well, I was on the Phillips Morin mailing list and they mailed it for me. I thought that was really interesting. So she buys her cigarettes on base and pays no tax at all.
Assembly debate on the increased tobacco tax will take place at the next assembly meeting. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey and Dave Donaldson also reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
In September, the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, 4As, experienced a theft of client information, including names, addresses, phone numbers, social security numbers, and health information. For questions about identity theft, 4As recommends you call the Federal Trade Commission at 877-438-4338 or the 4As at 800-478-2437 or visit their website, alaskanaids.org. This message is sponsored by 4As.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.